This week on Life and Faith.
How are we going to make the new world so that the people who are living forever can actually bear their existence within that world?
The story that we tell ourselves about our own history is a big part of how we shape ourselves as individuals.
By the time I got back, the president, Hamid Karzai, knew about it.
I do not fear death in any way.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart.
I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Max Jeganathan.
Yeah, special welcome to you, Max. You'll be featuring more on Life and Faith for the next little while as Natasha's stepped off to have a baby. So we're very glad you're here, Max.
They are insightful and eloquent shoes to fill, but I'm very excited to be here too.
That's great. Great to have you on board. This episode of Life and Faith is released March 28, which is Maundy Thursday, or right on the cusp of the events of Easter. Good Friday, the day Jesus was crucified. Easter Saturday, when he lay dead in the grave. And, of course, Easter Sunday, when he rose to new and everlasting life. That's the claim of Christianity, and it is one that fires all the work we do here at CPX.
Yeah. As you might be aware, a bunch of us at CPX have a go at writing and pitching Easter-themed articles to the mainstream press every year. Now, this is only my second year doing this for CPX, but some of us have been here a long time, and I hear you always have...
A very long time.
That's right. I hear you always have this same dilemma about Easter. What more is there to say about this, and what new angle can we come up with this year?
It is a dilemma for me every year to write an Easter article. If this isn't too heretical to say, it almost feels like our own descent into the grave at Easter in terms of staring at the screen. What am I going to write? This is going nowhere. This is terrible. It's going to end in death and I'm going to lose my job and all the rest
yep.
of it.
Yep.
But strangely enough, sometimes we emerge on the other side and it can feel like its own kind of triumph in a way. So I especially want to hear about that when it comes to your article, Max, but we're going to hear about that later.
Sure.
But this episode, we're letting you, our listeners, into the CPX writer's room as we discuss what we're writing about this year or hoping to write. Now, we've done a Life and Faith episode like this before where we talked about writing Easter pieces. So basically, this episode is about trying to make old things sound new again.
Now, we recorded this episode in the week before Easter. So Max, you're way ahead of me, having done it already. Well done.
Thank you. Getting there, I hope.
We're going to hear from Max a bit later about that experience. But before we get to the Easter Sunday experience, as Justine's described it here, we're going to go through some difficult times first, but take it away, Justine.
Yeah, well, to kick us off, I caught up with Natasha, who's in the process of writing about Marilyn Robinson's book on Genesis, Reading Genesis. As you know, Marilyn Robinson is an author highly beloved by CPX, and she's now applied her skills to reading the book of the Bible, Genesis. So I started by asking her, Natasha, that is, given how tired and overworked she must feel at this point in the few weeks leading up to birthday, was she disappointed that Marilyn Robinson didn't write something with a more obviously Easter-friendly angle?
I suppose part of the beauty of Marilyn Robinson is that whatever she's writing about, she's sort of writing about everything. Like in the world, she's writing about beauty and humanity and grace and freedom and joy and in a way that is not saccharine or generic. So, you know, this wonderful new book of hers, Reading Genesis, is about reading Genesis, but it's also about what it is to be human. And so, you know, Easter is like not that far a jump, I think.
Can you give us a bit of a brief snapshot of what she's doing in this book and also what you're noticing as you read it?
Mm.
Is it that she's seeing something from an entirely different perspective that hasn't occurred to you before, or what's really staying with you?
Mm. It sort of reads like she's a, you know, a literary scholar and also sort of a theologian who's carefully reading through the book of Genesis, like sequentially, and taking us with her in a way that doesn't concede that much to the reader who needs to be convinced to be interested in Genesis. So like even, you know, the first line is like, the Bible is a theodicy, a meditation on the problem of evil. Like, she's not humoring you and being like, hey, here's why you should be interested. She's like, let's dive in here. And that's maybe potentially hard going for the first few pages. But then, you know, if like me, you love her prose, you do kind of fall under the spell of what she's talking about. And she really does take you alongside her as she reads these texts that she deeply loves and has deeply meditated on, and has deeply meditated on all the people who've been deeply meditating on these texts for centuries, for actually millennia. And I think at the end of the day, what it's really about, there are themes that come up throughout it, such as how wrong we are when we think about the God of Genesis as this quite, you know, distant, wrathful, scary God, that we actually have the opposite kind of reaction to what we should, that these stories are stories, we read vengeance into them because that's what we expect, but they're often, potentially always, stories where vengeance doesn't happen, where God chooses forgiveness and mercy and forbearance instead, even when judgment is well deserved. So Cain kills his brother Abel, the first brothers. You've written a wonderful article yourself about sibling rivalry and it going back to Cain and Abel. You know, right before that, God has introduced this rule that's meant to limit human vengeance and also meant to acknowledge the sacredness, the sanctity of human life, which is that if someone takes a human life, then their life will be taken in response. That's a proportionate response. You take life, you lose life. But that's not what God does with Cain. Cain kills his brother, which is conceivably even worse than killing just anybody. So God doesn't not punish Cain, but he doesn't proportionately punish Cain. Cain goes on and lives and flourishes and has all these descendants who do all these amazing things. So in the case where you'd expect vengeance, actually you get this forbearance. So she is kind of often showing us, you know, we think this is maybe a primitive text, an unsophisticated text, and it really, really isn't. And someone who has kind of the sophisticated reading and writing skills of Marilynne Robinson is well equipped to show us that. But I think the biggest thing for me that this book is about, and partly because it's something, it's a question that I wrestle with a lot and that really fascinates me, is kind of the disjunction between all of humanity, the multitudes of people, the generations, the nations, and the itty-bitty story of one person and one family line. So Genesis is kind of weirdly this cosmic narrative, God creating everything, and it encompasses all of humanity and God's relationship with them. But it's also like mostly the story of a bunch of petty family squabbles, these not very noble, not very upright people making all kinds of errors and getting all kinds of stuff wrong. And it's both at the same time. And I think the beauty of what Robinson is talking about is how those two things link together, how there's a God who kind of is bringing about this vast sweep of human history, but doing that around and with respect to and with attention to and through the everyday living, dying, birthing, jealousy, infertility, sorrow, wronging each other of just really human people who lived a really long time ago but are recognisably like us.
Marilynne Robinson's a very interesting person. She is someone who bridges worlds, right? I mean, Obama loves her. Any book that she writes is going to be guaranteed an article in any of the kind of mainstream periodicals that we have. She's also deeply Christian at the same time, as you've explained. But not everyone who loves her work will share her faith. How does she, or does she, make faith a live question for people?
Yeah, I find this fascinating because, you know, this is something that you and I try to do all the time in our work. We're trying to talk about things of faith to people who share it and people who don't, to be able to have that common conversation across lines of faith. And we do that in a particular way usually, which is to kind of meet people on common ground, and where your beliefs are not shared by others, to explain them, to concede this is what I believe. I'm not saying that you have to believe it kind of thing. And there's a courtesy to that in public common spaces. And Robinson does that in a really different way. So she's incredibly courteous, but she's also like unapologetically, she's just like treating the God of Genesis as though he's the real God. And this is actually about human history. It's about your experience and my experience. And she's not kind of making concessions or apologies. Like in past essays that she's written, she'll be talking very casually about the Puritans or about this idea of heaven that she takes to be real in an essay about gun culture in America or about why we have universities. And these are everyone questions, and she thinks that the Puritans or Calvin or whoever have something to say about that because we live in this world where God is real and where what the Bible says is relevant to all these things because it speaks truth. And it's interesting to see people react to that. So, you know, she appeared on the Ezra Klein show, the New York Times podcast. And so far as I know, Ezra Klein, who is Jewish, is not religious, but he very much enters into everything that she's talking about in the book. Like, obviously, he values and is familiar with the text of Genesis, but doesn't necessarily believe it, so far as I can tell. But he's meeting her on her terms and kind of going, okay, you're talking about all these things to do with humans. And he can see that her insights into those things are valuable, even if perhaps he or others don't agree on where they've come from. Whereas there was a review in The New Yorker by James Wood, who, it's a very sophisticated version of this, but it's essentially kind of saying, but wait, God's not real. Like, can we remember as we read this book that God's not real? Like, and just bumps up against her assumption that actually these are things we should take seriously. So I think to come to read Marilyn Robinson as someone who doesn't share her understanding of life and the universe, I think you can still completely enter into the vision that she has of humanity and of the world. It's like, given whatever your premises are, then what do things look like from that set of assumptions? And then how do I feel about that? Do I find that generative? Do I find that interesting? Do I find that beautiful? Do I find that true in terms of what I do know about myself and about other humans and the world we live in? So yeah, I find her approach fascinating, and probably it only works because she's very brilliant. Don't know if it would work for everyone.
Okay, now hit me with your Easter angle then. Ooh. Like, firstly, where are you in the writing process at the moment? Are you making notes? Are you starting to just chuck words down on the page? Where are you right now?
I have made many notes, and I have been digesting, and I think I sort of know where I'm going. So I'm going to tell you where I think I'm going. It might change as the lines are etched in stone.
The pros will tell you as they come about.
So I want to talk about that idea of, you know, the sweep of history as opposed to the concrete particular person and moment, because, you know, Robinson talks about these like hinge moments, these things that seem very everyday and unimportant, Jacob and Esau kind of having their brotherly clashes, and actually so much history hinging on what happens or doesn't happen there. Jacob deceives his father and his brother and kind of tricks them out of his inheritance, which God presumably intended him to have all along. Esau could take revenge and kill him. Jacob's very worried that he will. These things kind of are playing out in human terms, but also the text argues, or the text just assumes, it's all within God's providence that he's playing this out, and the nation of Israel and then the descendants of Abraham in the sense of people of faith, Christians, all of that will kind of flow out of these little moments. And, you know, you have a cross outside of Jerusalem nearly 2,000 years ago now, this kind of hinge moment, just a Friday that might come and go, and someone's brutally murdered by the Romans happens all the time. But actually, this is the hinge point of human history. You know, if you don't think that God is involved there, if you think this is an entirely human story, then it's a massive hinge point of human history regardless, because people have believed it and that's changed what's happened in our world. But if you do believe that God is involved and God is actually on that cross, then it's this very specific, very visceral moment that looks like it could have gone all sorts of ways, but has gone this way. And as a result, so many other things flow from that. A lot of people find it absurd, the kind of claim of Easter, the claim of Christianity, that it does hinge on this particular little pocket of human history in this particular place and time. And if it's meant to be universal and for everyone, that seems weirdly specific. But actually, the weirdly specific is sort of all we have. Like, the huge universal is made up of the weirdly specific. And the claim of Genesis and the claim of the whole Bible is that God really tenderly, intently cares about the specific, and the specific of, you know, his son on that cross, his son risen from that tomb, but also the specifics of your life and my life.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and we're talking about writing Easter articles. Now, hopefully by the time this episode's released, they'll be written and soon to be published. Now, the Easter story, of course, doesn't change year to year, but we do need to try to find ways of grabbing people's attention and reminding them of its relevance. And that's a challenge, and, you know, for me at least, I'd say, coming up with something new and fresh.
It's not just you.
Each year, not
all,
just me.
It's all of us.
Yeah, and sometimes the articles, though, are evergreen. I've had situations, to be honest, where I've written one, hasn't made it into a piece, but I've pulled it up the year after and got it in.
Reheated it.
It's happened at Christmas as well, actually. So you've got to be patient in this game.
Nothing is wasted. Yeah.
Nothing wasted, exactly. And Justine, do you ever feel like this about your pieces?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I had a piece published in the Herald a couple of years ago. It was about public holidays and about our total work culture. And it was especially, I guess, timely because we were just emerging from lockdown and everyone was exhausted, but we felt this demand to, okay, get back out there, start doing all the things. And so I feel like that's always relevant. It's not, I can't blame lockdown. I'm just permanently running. And I think just noticing, you know, looking around at each of us, it's only March and we're already feeling it.
So that atmosphere hasn't changed very much since then. So speaking of dates, it's the case that sometimes the calendar and the moon are the things that push us along. Easter, not everyone knows this, but Easter is the first Sunday after the full moon on or after March 21 each year. So it's the autumn equinox for those of us who are in the southern hemisphere. So it's early this year, but sometimes Easter is very near to Anzac Day in Australia, which is April 25. Now, I've written about that before, where those two things seem to have a common theme in lots of ways and a whole lot of, you know, different ways, and we sort of teased that out. But it was interesting to me at how much meaning and significance is attached to especially that idea of sacrifice. And that's why I wanted to sort of pick up on that. There are gravestones that I've seen at Gallipoli that say things like, not goodbye, but good night, or our dear son who has lost his life to find it. And these are kind of very evocative terms and speak to a particular era too, because they're very common on the war graves to see these sorts of lines. But of course, that reference that I made earlier is a line from Jesus, who says that whoever seeks his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. It's a very Christian idea of laying down your life in order to pick it up in its fullest and richest sense. And that was carried over in these gravestones. I found that very moving. There's a very Easter theme in this, that true life is found in sort of surprising places, including in death and sacrifice at that time of year. We often think in those terms. Now, what about you, Max? Your piece that you've written is slated for The Guardian, which is great.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I wrote this year about heroes and saviours, and specifically what All the superhero narratives in our fictional universes tell us about who we are and what we're looking for and what we're longing for. We have these superhero narratives that really consume and capture a lot of the public imagination, but what does that actually mean? Is it more about the escape? Is it more about the entertainment? Or are there deeper things in our human hearts that our love of superheroes from very young to very old ages seems to speak to? And I wind up exploring the difference between heroes and saviours, what the difference between these two things are. And what it really comes down to in my article as I explore these issues is the need for relatability. That's really the difference between superheroes that we kind of look up to that are a bit more beyond and abstracted from us and saviours in our lives, the people and the things in our lives that really speak to us, that relate to us. And this isn't lost on, you know, the writers of fictional superhero narratives either. You know, Superman was a refugee, you know, Spider-Man was an orphan. These things come up again and again, but they really just give us a glimpse, as many of the thinkers and scholars in this space have said, a glimpse into the spiritual nature of who we are and our need for rescue.
I found it really interesting that you mentioned the sociologist John Carroll, who I believe, Simon, you talked to, right, on Life and Faith earlier about Harry Potter. Mm. And Max, this is what you write in your article. You say, ancient Greeks honed the archetype of the hero with warriors like Homer's Achilles, but it was Jesus who introduced the paradigm of the savior. And I find that so interesting because I've heard people talk about the distinction between like heroes from the DC universe versus heroes from the Marvel universe, and how all these Zack Snyder heroes are really about enlarging themselves, whereas all the heroes in the Marvel universe, Spider-Man, Captain America, etc., they actually do sacrifice. Right. So it's a weird thing where Jesus, maybe, if this is right, has shaped our idea of heroism in a way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I've definitely found that, not just in my life, but when I look at the broader picture of what's out there in terms of superheroes. Heroes become saviours when there's an element of sacrifice and when there is a transition and even a transformation from exhibiting greatness, which we all love, to something that I think is far more profoundly relatable, which is goodness. And so when we think about some of these heroes out there, you know, from people like Mother Teresa through to Harry Potter, we see glimpses not just of greatness, but we see this thing called goodness, which always comes with sacrifice and, as John Carroll correctly says, has traces of Jesus in it.
Yeah.
There's tons of films and novels that picked up on that theme, right?
Yes.
And people love it. There's something very attractive.
Well, they love it, but then you also mentioned Plato, right? Yeah, like just what you were now saying about greatness and goodness.
Yes.
And how goodness is a higher bar in some ways. But you mentioned Plato. I'd never heard this before. Maybe you should tell us about that. What do you say about Plato in your piece?
Well, Plato talks about in one of his works, The Apology, and he's actually referring to the life of Socrates kind of in an indirect way, but he talks about what would happen if someone came along that perfectly embodied truth and goodness and virtue in its most perfect form. And Plato's hypothetical speculation was, if someone like that ever came into the world that embodied perfect truth and goodness, that we wouldn't be able to handle it. The broken human condition couldn't handle it, and so we would kill them. And it was just 400 years later that, you know, the biographies of Jesus unfolded just across the Mediterranean, not that far from Plato's Athens, which I find it quite chilling and quite extraordinary.
Yeah. It's like we aspire to greatness, but goodness is
what we need.
Is what we need. And we do want it, but we don't want it at the same
Correct.
Time.
Because I think our society valorizes greatness, but goodness is actually what our hearts want.
What about the idea of converting us to a different understanding of what greatness is, though?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think deep down for me, where in looking back on my life as a Christian and looking at the Easter story, that's what Jesus does. He redefines what greatness is and he infuses it with things like goodness and sacrifice, some of these deeper things that human hearts are looking for.
His famous line in Mark's gospel where he pulls his disciples together and says, you know, you want to know what greatness is? Yeah, you've got to come a slave to people.
Right, you know? Right, spot on.
Then he kind of lives that out.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about the writing process, because I remember a couple of days in the office where you were looking a bit down in the dumps. Now, what was this piece like to write?
Yes, well, as you know, I'm relatively new at this. I'm not a seasoned pro like the rest of you are. And so it's always a little bit terrifying and exciting at the same time. But I quite enjoyed this one because it started with me just looking back through my childhood. So this is a lot. The article I wrote tracks a lot with my personal story of faith. And I started off as a kid, like many kids, fascinated with superheroes, specifically Superman. And I was a big Superman guy and he...
Loved Superman.
Loved Superman, right?
Yeah. He is Batman.
Yeah, they don't make him like they used to with either of these guys. But as I got older, For me, my love for Superman really gave way to my reliance and dependence and admiration of far less quote-unquote super people, but just extraordinary people in my own life. My parents, then later my wife, you know, my friends, people that I would consider my heroes now are not the kind of heroes I used to deify and valorize when I was a kid. And so the article just kind of explores that, that kind of grafted and gave the backbone to a lot of the writing framework, I think, and then that, and then it just kind of flowed from there. But it's always a nerve-wracking process, you know, writing and then rewriting and then revising. And thankfully we're blessed with a fantastic writing ecosystem here with this team. So I'm always very grateful for that. But yeah, got there in the end.
And did Max DeJour kind of shift away from the superheroes towards, you know, other people come at the same time that you realise Superman, depressingly, isn't real?
It did come at a similar time.
Yeah.
I think even when I realised it wasn't real, I think that gave way to me thinking, well, maybe I could be Superman.
Yeah.
So I lived happily in that delusion for a little while and then shifted back to reality.
Yeah.
But enough about me. What about you guys? Didn't you both want to write about death denial and what happened there?
Yeah, well, the one idea I had, I think Justine's taken.
She stole it.
So I'm back to the drawing board, but she's done it. Great job of it, so it doesn't matter.
That's,
it's fabulous. Very,
look, if I can blame anything, I can blame my writer's block, which made me a thief. Look, you've written a lot about immortality, and that's this idea that you want to pause at the best part of your life and linger there forever using exercise and, I don't know, Pilates and all the rest of it. It's like how Jennifer Aniston looks the same as she did when she was on Friends,
right,
you know, back in the 90s.
Yeah. Always.
But I took this idea of death denial through the hinterlands of Silicon Valley biohacking.
Right.
Yeah.
Particularly inspired by this guy, Brian Johnson, who is a tech billionaire and an entrepreneur. And he's 46 years old, but he gets a group of scientists to kind of manage his diet, to monitor all his inputs and outputs. And the idea is that he wants to have the body of an 18-year-old forever. And so far, people have said that he now has the bones of a 30-year-old and the heart of a 37-year-old.
Wow.
So how you can measure these things is one thing. But
it doesn't look great, though.
It might be one of those things where maybe you don't live forever, but it just feels
like feels like forever.
Maybe. But there's a lot of green juices involved and carefully calibrated exercises and so on. So Brian Johnson basically wants to live forever, and he thinks that science will help him do that.
Yeah.
Fascinating, right?
Fascinating. Fascinating. Now, you make the point that, you know, these aspirations to cheat death, that they're actually very religious, but they're just rebranded in a way. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, I've talked about this before, but this idea that maybe Silicon Valley types aren't into God anymore, but their dreams of the kind of society they're trying to build or the particular life they want to live seems just like, you know, scooped up from the Christian idea of immortality and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's like religion in new guises, but among a people who would not see themselves as typically religious.
Yeah, it's a beautifully written piece. But interestingly, as you were writing it, you described it at one point as being such a downer. Why is that?
I suppose I felt like it was a really depressing read because I make the case that, you know, the 3 days of Easter, let's say Good Friday when Jesus goes into the grave, Easter Saturday when he's lying dead there, and then Easter Sunday when he rises to new life, those 3 days in some ways capture the human condition.
Right.
In terms of, we know death is coming and we really desire life, or we desire to extend life indefinitely, but we live in Easter Saturday, or life feels like Easter Saturday. We're permanently stuck between life and death, or death and life in this case. And so the further I lent into that idea of what life is like just on Easter Saturday, without Easter Sunday coming, right? Just your hopes that one day you can live forever. It just felt really grim. Because you're left with this idea that all of it is just a fairy tale. Like any kind of goodness, any lasting justice, any love is just something that we have to tell ourselves so we can put another foot in front of the other.
So we can just get through the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt like it was quite depressing in that sense. That's why it's a downer.
Yeah, sure. That's fair enough. There's more hope in it than I think you realised when you first wrote it.
Okay, all right.
But that's fair.
Yeah, you did emerge from the Good Friday-ness.
Yes, from the shadows.
Whatever you were feeling.
Yeah.
And one other thing, Justine, you make a distinction between individual and social transformation. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so if just say Brian Johnson can solve the death problem, that seems to make it...
Which seems a bit of a long shot,
sure,
at this stage.
Sure, like, but let's just go with it, right? Like, it would probably be mostly open to people who are kind of like him,
yes,
right? Very rich and very powerful. And I just want to, you know, follow the logic and say that, look, even if you can get all the rich and powerful to live forever, is that really going to fix our problems?
Yeah.
Or is it going to make it worse?
The problems are deeper than
just
dying.
Yeah, solving the death issue is only one piece of the puzzle. It's like we want a new world. How are we going to make the new world so that the people who are living forever can actually bear their existence within that world? So you need a transformation that is kind of much bigger than just solving the problem of how can I live forever?
Yeah, the longing is shared, right? So the sort of secular person like him is trying to do it all without God is similar to but very different to the believer who thinks, yeah, I long for this too, but I actually think it's beyond us, but God can do it and only God can do that. That to me sums up a lot of this sort of wrestling for human achievement that can only take us so far.
Yeah, and you've written about this too, right, in terms of there's a cosmic kind of restoration in store for the cosmos.
That's right. I think that, you know, what we've touched on here is all this very important element of the Easter story, which is the darkness, the brokenness, the failures, the ways in which we're all recognising that life isn't what we can imagine it to be. And we're all, if we're at all thoughtful about this, conscious of it. But this is a story that says, yes, that's true, but there's a possibility. Because of the claim of the resurrection, there is this window into a possibility. And, you know, one of our favourite lines, I think, collectively here at CPX is Francis Bufford's line when he talks about this, which is, this story tells you that far more can be mended than you know. You've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, Natasha Moore, Max Jeganathan and Justine Toe.
So do keep an eye on our socials to see the Easter articles as they're published, or you can sign up for our newsletter to keep up with all our content. There's a link in our show notes.
And if you've enjoyed this episode, please share it, send it on to someone else.
And as always, a big thanks to our producer, the long-suffering Alan Douthwaite.
So long-suffering.
And happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Next week.
I started working in the West Bank and Gaza during the first Intifada in 1990. From there, I went to the Balkans and reported the Bosnian War, later on the war in Kosovo, most of the upheaval in that region throughout the 90s. I also worked in Africa extensively in that time. Later, after 9/11, I reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, and then the Arab Spring, as well as the war in Syria for many years. So I think it's around 18 wars and sadly 3 genocides over 35 years now.